of Excel at Microsoft has different requirements than a spreadsheet developer at Lotus. So those diverse sets of requirements really drove their product definition much differently than what was done in the applications arena. Sharing and interoperability mechanisms. Microsoft developers interconnect the Office components or any other shared components and applications using a variety of interoperability mechanisms, such as object linking and embedding, OLE, and dynamic link libraries. Developers call these interoperability mechanisms because they enable two or more applications to cooperate by sharing components and data or synchronizing operations. We noted in Chapter 3 that OLE is a specific Microsoft product that enables object sharing and interoperability. This product unit has 15 developers, 15 testers, 3 program managers, and 3 user education personnel. The developers use C++. OLE enables one application to request a service, such as draw this graph or format this text, from another application. It can then embed the results of the request into the output that the original application displays. Users can build compound documents, including text, data, and graphics, using OLE. Chris Graham recalled a humorous incident where someone demonstrating Excel requested a text editing service from Word using OLE, and it fooled Bill Gates, but only for a minute. OLE is a huge investment we've made in integration. An example is, Bill Gates was walking through the Excel hallways. To boost the morale of the development teams, he will tour the development hallways sometimes and talk to each development feature team lead. The team lead will show his features, and Bill will comment on them. And when he was looking at OLE, they switched to OLE in-place editing using Word. And for the first minute or two, Bill didn't realize that. He thought Excel looked kind of funny. And all of a sudden, he realized that Word was doing the in-place editing. So the integration of working using components in compound documents will be very high, and we think that's a scenario that matters to users. OLE affects not only applications products, but systems products and custom-built applications as well. For example, two of the OLE 2.0 architects spent 50% of their time talking to developers for systems products. OLE team members also consulted ISVs who want to use Office as the basic building block for their products. OLE provides a flexible mechanism for them to write specialized components or servers that encapsulate their products and enable close integration with the Office applications. Dynamic link libraries, DLLs, provide another general sharing technique, but they are not a specific product. A DLL is an add-in piece of software that the operating system can load into memory automatically while an application is running. Various application programs can then share this as a service. Different applications can share DLL services, such as spell checking, special device drivers, foreign language interfaces, and many other components that do not need to be loaded in memory and accessed continually. A major advantage of DLLs is that they reduce the maximum amount of memory consumed by an application at any given time. Reuse. Microsoft reuses a significant amount of code, over 50%, within a series of versions for a particular product, such as from version 1.0 to 2.0 and across the PC and Macintosh platforms. Reusing code decreases costs and reduces effort because a developer can simply implement a feature once rather than once for each version or platform. Excel 4.0, for example, had 69.4% code shared across the Windows and Macintosh platforms, 15.4% Macintosh-specific code, and 15.1% Windows-specific code. Microsoft also applies many approaches for reusing code across separate products, such as sharing components, VBA, for example, sharing a common API, or stealing what you can opportunistically. In the component reuse approach, developers provide standalone utilities, such as drawing or graphing functions, that products can share via OLE or DLLs. The Microsoft Foundation classes, MFC, provide a set of reusable C++ functions and are one example of the common API approach, as Dave Moore explained. People use these foundation classes as the basis for their coding. The theory is that there will be a set of routines from every application that has a greater chance of being shareable, since they have a common structure of memory use and function management from a standard library. But we haven't mandated that people use these object-oriented techniques. The Foundation class is a component library that shipped with our Visual C++ toolset. Common APIs, such as MFC, may dramatically reduce the number of API calls necessary to system and user interface services by as much as a 5-to-1 ratio, according to Chris Graham. Projects also opportunistically copy code from other products and then adapt it to their needs. Of the approximately 4 million source lines of code in Windows NT, for example, developers reuse about 35% from previous systems such as Windows 3.1, DOS 4.0, and OS 2, as well as from the languages group. Lou Perizzoli elaborated on the steal what you can reuse approach on Windows NT. Windows 3.1 has the same debugging utilities. In fact, we ripped off a lot of their code, so don't think we invented everything from scratch. That is not NT. We took code from the Windows group when appropriate. Windows is split into this function called User and GDI, Graphics Device Interface, where User manages the square windows and GDI does the drawing stuff. We took all their user code because it was in C and ported that. All the applications were ported over, like the file manager and the shell. The command interpreter was written for a product called DOS 4, which then evolved into OS 2, so we took that command interpreter and ported it to NT. The languages guys gave us C runtimes, libraries. We didn't care where they came from. In general, Microsoft has extensive opportunities to reuse existing code because developers have written tremendous quantities of code for a multitude of products. The small-team, self-sufficient Microsoft culture provides one possible explanation why developers have not reused code more often. The fast pace of change in the consumer software industry provides another explanation, although this can also be an excuse not to make more of an effort to share. Microsoft groups are now learning how to share more of what they build. Nevertheless, even Gates acknowledged that projects still do not reuse as much code as they could. We use these small development teams. They love to be very self-sufficient, so they don't go and share code across other teams as much as they could. Now, we have more code than most places have, so we share more code than I think anybody else you'll find in the world. We also fail to share more code than anybody else you'll find in the world. I can give you some great successes. There's only one piece of charting code in the whole company, but there's a lot of pieces of text processing code. I can explain how we got there and why it's not as stupid as it might seem, but if we'd been super clever about architecting the requirements and the framework, we could have avoided a lot of inefficiency there. 7. Attack the future. In our descriptions of Microsoft's strategies and their specific principles, we have detailed a number of company strengths. We will review them here briefly while highlighting capabilities that are useful for other companies to learn from and that should help Microsoft perform well in the future. We also discuss what we feel are Microsoft's key weaknesses, both actual and potential, and the lessons these provide for other firms. We then conclude this book with a discussion of Microsoft's strategic challenges and how we think Microsoft will implement its most fundamental strategy, Attack the Future, based on how products, markets, and technologies seem to be evolving. Underlying our thoughts in this final chapter are several assumptions about the future. First, we believe that PC software will become even more sophisticated in terms of functionality, and thus more difficult for companies like Microsoft to build. New products will bring together numerous features previously found in separate applications programs, operating systems, and network communications products. Second, at the same time, we believe that future PC software, from the user's perspective, will become even simpler and more reliable. It will enable millions and perhaps billions of novice home consumers to use computers for a variety of daily tasks with increasing frequency. Third, we believe that high technology markets, such as PC software, change quickly enough so that we cannot reliably predict whether Microsoft will still be the world's most powerful software company a decade from now. Nor can we say for certain that Microsoft will successfully leverage its current market positions and extend its dominance to new and very different markets, such as online services or multimedia publishing. All we know is that we would not bet against Microsoft. We are sure that it will compete aggressively in these and other new markets. It also brings a host of existing products, customers, standards, technical capabilities, and organizational resources that will make it one of the world's most powerful companies for many years to come. Key strengths. Microsoft is one of those rare companies where leadership, strategy, people, culture, and opportunity come together to create an extraordinarily effective organization. This should be apparent whether a reader likes or dislikes Microsoft products or how the company behaves. The company. The seven strategies and sets of principles that we have enumerated in this book reflect fundamental strengths that enable Microsoft to function so effectively. We summarize them below. First, we must point to Microsoft's exceptional chief executive and senior management team. Bill Gates is an extraordinary leader, and he has assembled an effective brain trust to support him. Microsoft managers know their technology and markets and how to make money with this knowledge, as well as or better than any top management team in any company. They have also created an organization superbly tailored to competing in a rapidly evolving and expanding set of markets. Second, Microsoft has thousands of carefully screened and talented employees, known for their intelligence, technical skills, and business savvy, as well as their aggressive entrepreneurial spirit and willingness to work countless hours on behalf of the company. They come from a wide and growing variety of backgrounds, which creates diversity within the organization. These people also have the talent to take on extensive responsibilities, including defining their job skills, hiring and training new people, and creating linkages across different parts of the company. Third, Microsoft exhibits highly effective and coherent competitive strategies and organizational goals. It is clear to Microsoft employees that the company leaders do not value technology for technology's sake or believe in adhering to rules or procedures over shipping products. Bill Gates and other Microsoft managers value making money. They are interested in bang for the buck and mass markets, and they believe that delivering value to customers will make the most money. Gates and other managers also seem to know when to enter new or evolving markets and when to shift their focus. They replace obsolete technologies before the competition does this for them. They clearly understand how to cultivate a huge installed base of products and customers. They set standards that maintain sales and profits, as well as generate new markets, and they take advantage of being the standards provider. They can also see that the true mass market of the future centers around the novice home consumer. Fourth, Microsoft has a flexible, incremental approach to product development and organizational evolution. Microsoft's system of product development enables teams and individuals to alter specifications and designs during a project and build products by incrementally evolving features targeting specific customer activities. Moreover, Microsoft's organization exhibits the same type of flexibility and incrementalism we see in its products and projects. We have seen the company shift relatively easily from one market and customer set to another. Managers move people around, add groups, and reorganize continuously as technologies and markets change. And Microsoft people manage the evolution of products, projects, and the overall organization with a remarkable minimum of politics and bureaucracy. Fifth, Microsoft clearly has processes for product development and other operations that combine efficiency with the ability to work in parallel. Company profits are high despite the fact that Microsoft prices products relatively low. At least part of the reason is that Microsoft takes advantage of scale and scope economies in many areas. It has accumulated vast knowledge in developing and testing software products, and it now shares many components and tools across different projects. It produces huge numbers of new products and moves them into wholesale and retail sales channels with astounding ease. The company funds growing amounts of research and development from corporate revenues. Different groups rely on the same centralized usability lab, and there is centralized training and tools development for customer support. The thousands of calls that Microsoft receives daily provide an invaluable source of feedback from customers. Other areas subject to scale economies include operations such as product packaging, distribution, and advertising. At the same time, Microsoft's processes for product development and other operations promote efficiency and flexibility by organizing many tasks in parallel, with overlapping responsibilities and skills, and work assigned to small, multifunctional teams. Sixth, Microsoft people have an orientation towards self-critiquing, learning, and improving. Product groups study past projects, looking for what went right and what went wrong, and what to do the next time around. Unlike in past years, Microsoft also pays close attention to customer questions, complaints, and suggestions, analyzing this information as if it were a gold mine and channeling this feedback quickly into the product development organization. Microsoft is increasingly using quantitative measures or metrics to understand products, projects, and customer reactions. And the various product groups are finding new ways to share technology and components to reduce redundancies, present a more coherent set of products to customers, and become even more integrated and efficient as a company. Seventh, Microsoft people have demonstrated a relentless pursuit of future markets. They have not yet become complacent, as Richard Barth observed. Steve Ballmer is pretty aggressive about reminding us that we put our pants on one leg at a time and that there are other people who are at least as hungry as we are coming after us. We also think that Attack the Future, a strategy we will elaborate on later in this chapter, is an accurate characterization of Microsoft's behavior since 1975. Bill Gates and Paul Allen displayed this attitude first by going after what then was a practically non-existent mass market for PC programming languages. Since then, Microsoft has gone after other waves of new or evolving mass markets and created some markets as well. Gates and his staff continue to look several years into the future as they evaluate new ideas such as multimedia publishing, interactive television, and other products and services for the information highway and the novice consumer. Product development. Microsoft, like any company, is really a human system. It works because of how well Microsoft people bring together various technical skills and the market knowledge necessary to compete and then put their ideas into practice. It is difficult to say that any one element is more important than another. In this book, however, we have spent considerable time talking about the strategies and principles by which Microsoft develops new products. Our reasoning is that product development is central to everything Microsoft does. The company's survival and prosperity have always depended on new products, from Altair Basic to MS-DOS, Word, Excel, Windows, Office, Windows NT, Windows 95, the Microsoft Network, and beyond. For example, Microsoft's revenues would have collapsed in the 1990s if it had not been able to deliver new versions of Word and Excel, then integrate both within the Office suite. These products now account for about half of revenues and profits. Simply to sustain its sales of operating systems, Microsoft has had to move beyond MS-DOS to Windows. It has now successfully built two versions of Windows NT, and early indications are that it will have a commercially successful new product in Windows 95. Microsoft must also continuously add useful features to convince its millions of existing customers to buy new versions of products that are already adequate for most people. To grow in the future, Microsoft plans to create a huge variety of consumer products that incorporate advanced multimedia and network communications technologies. Clearly, a critical question Microsoft faces is whether the company can continue to evolve its development capabilities and build ever larger and more intricate software products and software-based information services. As we have suggested, Microsoft must also greatly simplify many of these products in order to market them successfully to the world's billions of novice home consumers. We have argued that Microsoft has already demonstrated impressive capabilities in product development, and that the company deserves credit for continually refining these capabilities. Overall, we feel that Microsoft's product development organization is really the heart and future of the company, and should continue to do well because of the strengths it exhibits. First, the product development organization effectively supports Microsoft's competitive strategy, which is to design products for the mass market and then improve these products incrementally by enhancing existing features or adding new ones. Microsoft also tries to establish industry standards and then take advantage of these new standards with new products. Product units support this objective by turning out continual streams of compatible new products and new versions for which millions of customers pay additional money each time they upgrade. Second, the product development organization works well because its processes and objectives are highly consistent with Microsoft's culture and goals. Program managers and developers have large amounts of freedom to evolve features by experimenting with designs and user reactions. The emphasis is on individual specialists making decisions, but sharing responsibilities and working in small teams with a minimum of bureaucratic control. Older firms in the software industry may describe this as a hacker culture, due to the lack of firmer controls over what people and projects do. But the sync and stabilize techniques we have described, daily builds, milestone integration periods, buddy testers, and private releases, allow individuals and small teams to work relatively independently as well as together. Third, like the company organization overall, Microsoft's culture promotes a process for product development that combines efficiency and structure with flexibility. Divisions easily expand their product portfolios. Individuals have the freedom to make many changes in the products they develop and to alter or tailor their processes and tools. Throughout the company, however, there is a reasonably well-defined process for software development and other key activities. Flexibility is especially important in software development because it is difficult to predict at the beginning of many projects how products will ultimately turn out or how users will respond to product features. In the packaged, as opposed to custom, software business, companies also face a problem somewhat akin to writing best-selling books and then sequels that please a dedicated audience. A single, highly structured development process is not always useful because there is no specific formula for producing a bestseller. However good the process is, the ideas, the people who do the actual writing, the market timing, and advertising and customer support have more to do with ultimate success. Nonetheless, what firms can do is create product development processes that provide just enough structure for teams to experiment with designs and still successfully bring together the evolving pieces of the product they are creating. This requires subtle but effective coordination and communication. Fourth, Microsoft's approach to product development contains several mechanisms for incorporating feedback and learning, especially from customers, directly into the development process. We can see these in the analysis of user activities for product planning and the use of customer support data to prioritize features as well as generate feature ideas. We can also see these in the extensive reliance of program managers and developers on prototyping features in the usability lab, in how testers try to replicate the functional usage of a product, the huge beta tests at customer sites before the release of major new products such as Windows NT and Windows 95, and how developers and testers staff customer support phone lines after they introduce new products. Fifth, Microsoft's Sync and Stabilize approach has enabled the company to scale up the loosely structured small-team style of its early years and build sophisticated software systems relatively cheaply and quickly. There are some limits to Microsoft's techniques, which we discuss later. Still, although several Microsoft products and projects are now quite large, the employee groups devoted to them continue to work very much like nimble small teams. We believe that, with some modifications, Microsoft can continue to scale up its operations and build the complex software systems of the future. What Sync and Stabilize achieves. The principles behind the Sync and Stabilize philosophy achieve a difficult aim. They add a semblance of order to the fast-moving, often chaotic world of PC software development. There is no magic here. Rather, there are specific tools and techniques, a few rigid rules, and highly skilled people willing to follow these rules. Microsoft's entire development process helps individual developers frequently synchronize their work with other members of a team and stabilize their product in increments as components evolve. As we have suggested throughout this book, several elements distinguish Sync and Stabilize from older, sequential, and more rigid styles of product development. Table 7.1. Sync and Stabilize versus Sequential Development. Sync and Stabilize. Product development and testing done in parallel. Sequential Development. Separate phases done in sequence. Sync and Stabilize. Vision statement and evolving specification. Sequential development. Complete frozen specification and detailed design before building the product. Sync and stabilize. Features prioritized and built in 3 or 4 milestone sub-projects. Sequential development. Trying to build all pieces of a product simultaneously. Sync and stabilize. Frequent synchronizations, daily builds, and intermediate stabilizations, milestones. Sequential development. One late and large integration and system test phase at the project's end. Sync and stabilize. Fixed release and ship dates and multiple release cycles. Sequential development. Aiming for feature and product perfection in each project cycle. Sync and stabilize. Customer feedback continuous in the development process. Sequential development. Feedback primarily after development as inputs for future projects. Sync and stabilize. Product and process design so that large teams work like small teams. Sequential development. Working primarily as a large group of individuals in separate functional departments. First, Microsoft, similar to what is becoming more common in software and other industries, does not follow a sequential waterfall process. It does not treat product development and testing as separate phases done one after the other, albeit with iterations back and forth if things do not proceed exactly according to plan. Rather, Microsoft teams do development and testing in parallel. The process is similar to how individuals might hack away at designing, coding, and testing as they go. It also resembles incremental development and concurrent engineering practices in other industries that overlap many activities and phases. Second, Microsoft does not try to freeze a complete functional specification and detailed design before starting to build a product's components. Rather, Microsoft allows specifications to evolve, adding or cutting features, experimenting with design details, as projects proceed. The complete specification, thus, is more an output of a project than an input to the development process. Microsoft also has vision statements, but no real detailed design or documentation phase. The code is the detailed design and the documentation. This is, again, reminiscent of a hacker approach, but we think Microsoft has particularly effective mechanisms to keep changes more or less under control. Third, Microsoft does not try to build all the pieces of a product simultaneously, such as by breaking down a detailed design and assigning all the modules or features to different people and teams. Rather, Microsoft breaks up a design into features, prioritizes them, and then builds clusters of features in 3 or 4 milestones. Teams usually work on the most important features in the first milestone, the second most important features in the second milestone, and so on. For products where features are not so closely coupled, a project team will drop features from the last milestone if it falls too far behind in the schedule. Fourth, Microsoft does not try to bring together all the pieces of a product for the first time in one late and large integration and system test phase at the end of a project. This would occur if a project builds all pieces in parallel and has no way to synchronize or test them together during the development process. Rather, Microsoft uses the concept of frequent builds to synchronize the work of many individuals and teams on a daily or weekly basis. It also uses the concept of milestone subprojects to stabilize subsets of features in 3 or 4 increments. These practices resemble concurrent engineering and incremental builds used in some other firms. Nonetheless, we think Microsoft stands out for how well it has refined and institutionalized this style of product development. Fifth, Microsoft does not necessarily try to complete and perfect every feature proposed at the beginning of a project. Rather, and particularly with applications products, Microsoft will set time and personnel limits, then establish goals for reducing the most severe bugs. Teams will wait until the next release of the product to add features they could not complete in the previous project, or to fix minor bugs that they did not detect or could not fix. In this way, Microsoft avoids the common dilemma of working and reworking a product in an endless cycle of changes, additions, and bug fixes. Other software firms have multiple release cycles, as do companies and industries that put out annual or frequent model changes. Microsoft, though, has pushed this style of development and marketing further. It has even brought the idea of annual model changes to software, hence the names Windows 95 and Office 95. Of course, this strategy of annual models will backfire if Microsoft groups cannot predict schedules accurately. Adding the year to product names, however, creates additional pressure to finish within a given year. Sixth, Microsoft does not wait until after it has finished and marketed a product to collect and utilize customer feedback. Rather, Microsoft incorporates customer feedback continuously throughout the development process. This begins with analyses of users in the product planning phases and continues with the testing of prototypes in a usability lab and the delivery of pre-release versions to beta test sites. Furthermore, Microsoft sends to its development groups detailed weekly reports on customer inquiries made to the product support organization. This information affects future product designs as well as features currently under development. Seventh, Microsoft does not allow developers to write software as if no one else existed in the company. Nor does Microsoft build software with huge teams divided into designers, developers, and testers working sequentially in separate departments, handing off work to the next phase amid lots of rigid procedures and required documentation. Rather, Microsoft develops software in multifunctional teams, organizing its efforts so as to make large teams work like small teams. Mike Maples, at least in part, referred to this when he told us that we spend more of our time figuring out how to act small, be small, and think small than we do act big and think big. Making large teams work like small teams. The strategies and principles behind Microsoft's sync and stabilize approach also suggest valuable lessons for how to organize large teams, a common problem in many companies and industries. Part of the difficulty is in technical and management education. University science and engineering departments and management schools generally do not teach students how to work in or control large teams. University engineering projects are nearly always small in scale. People learn how to work alone or within a small group. The reality in many firms, however, is that large teams are necessary to build complex products in relatively short amounts of time. This is true even though small teams of highly skilled people are probably the best way to design almost any type of product whether it be a computer software program, an automobile, or an airplane. We think that Microsoft and other young companies, especially those from relatively new industries like PC software, have a lot to teach the world about managing teams and innovation. Table 7.2 and the sections that follow return to the strategies and principles that we have already discussed, but pull out the key elements that Microsoft uses to scale up its style of small team development. Table 7.2, making large teams work like small teams. Project size and scope limits. Clear and limited product vision, personnel and time limits. Divisible product architectures, modularization by features, subsystems, and objects. Divisible project architectures, feature teams and clusters, milestone subprojects. Small team structure and management. Many small multifunctional groups with high autonomy and responsibility. A few rigid rules to force coordination and synchronization. Daily builds, don't break the build bug rules, milestone stabilizations. Good communications within and across functions and teams. Shared responsibilities, one site, common language, non-bureaucratic culture. Product process flexibility to accommodate the unknown. Evolving specs, buffer time, evolving process. Project size and scope limits. We have discussed how Microsoft tries to place limits on the size and scope of its projects as one way to keep projects small. This happens in several ways, which we discuss below. Clear and limited product vision. Microsoft projects try to set clear boundaries on what each project will attempt to accomplish. Program managers, working with developers and product managers and data from customer support, do this through a concise vision statement that sets an achievable goal for the project. Chris Peters emphasized this point in his 1990 video. You have to have a clear goal. This is what helps a whole group of people, a group of 100 people, move in a common direction and helps decide what to do and what not to do. It's just as important to decide what a product that you're working on is not going to be as it is deciding what it will be. Microsoft finds this clarity of goals easier to achieve with second, third, or later versions of a product compared to totally new products. It is also usually possible for projects to prioritize features according to bang for the buck. If a feature looks cool but will take 6 people the entire development schedule to do and only a few customers are likely to use it, they will cut it. Personnel limits. We have noted that the product unit structure creates a de facto ceiling of how many people will work together on any one project. Microsoft is really a collection of small development centers, usually with no more than 300 or 400 people each. Each represents a multifunctional product development team composed of specification, development, testing, user education, and product planning specialists. Their size is relatively large compared to the days when Microsoft measured total employment in the dozens and projects had 4 or 5 people, but small compared to the 1,000 or more developers often used by competing software firms. Microsoft also focuses nearly all its people on shipping products, rather than on building up components or technologies for inventory or documenting processes and products. This focus on shipping products has both positive and negative elements. For example, a lack of process and product documentation can force teams to reinvent solutions to common problems. It also gives people more time, though, to focus on getting the product at hand to market. Time limits. Projects now get stricter boundaries on how much time people can spend on a given effort. Usually this is between 12 and 24 months for a new version of an existing product. These times are often longer for totally new products, such as Windows NT 3.0 or Microsoft Exchange, or major new versions of operating systems, such as Windows 95. We have discussed why operating systems are more difficult than applications to build in a predictable time frame. They require extensive testing to cover all possible user scenarios and present fewer opportunities to cut features or functions if the project runs behind schedule. Nonetheless, setting time limits, at least internally, helps people focus their creativity on getting a working version of the product together, even if it is not perfect or ready for commercial release to the marketplace. Projects will have time to make refinements later. Because projects prioritize features and create a working product as they go along, applications projects can often stop when they run out of time and still ship a marketable product. In contrast to the past, when some Microsoft projects were years late, many applications products in second or later versions now ship within a month or two of the originally estimated ship dates. Microsoft's record is far from perfect, however, with totally new products or major operating system changes. Complications also arise from interdependent components coming from other projects, such as those contained in recent versions of Office. Divisible product architectures. Perhaps more important than overall limitations on project resources, product architecture plays a crucial role in breaking down large teams into small teams. Modularization is common and necessary in the software industry and in many other engineering fields, and most companies design products by features, functions, or subsystems. Microsoft in the past has not always paid a lot of attention to defining a high-level architecture that is separate from the source code in its products. This is changing, however, as Microsoft's development groups, including those for OLE, Office, and Cairo, among others, are increasingly thinking in terms of divisible product architectures and shared components. Microsoft teams also effectively coordinate and synchronize the development of their components through the daily and weekly build process, as well as the milestone stabilizations. Modularization by features and functions. We have talked about how Microsoft breaks down applications products into features. Operating systems contain features as well as parts better described as functional components or subsystems. Since many of these components interact, projects must test them together at some point. However, teams can design many features or functional components independently. This makes it possible to break up one relatively large project into a set of small projects. Modularization by subsystems and objects. Microsoft is increasingly organizing features and functions as dynamic link library, DLL, subsystems, or object linking and embedding, OLE, components that more than one product can use. These subsystems and objects require extensive coordination in the initial planning and design stages to define their technical details and interfaces. Designing products from shared subsystems and objects and designing code to be shared involves many adjustments during the development process. In general, however, these components again make it possible to subdivide projects into teams that work relatively independently, at least during the development stage. Divisible product architectures. We have discussed how Microsoft divides projects in a way that mirrors the structure of its products. This practice helps teams create products with logical and efficient designs, and it results in project organizations with logical and efficient groupings of people. Feature and component teams. Projects contain several feature teams or component teams. Each concentrates on building one or more of the features or functions that make up the design of the product. The team structure thus mirrors the product structure, and keeping the number of teams and their size small usually results in a more tightly integrated product. Feature and component clusters. Microsoft prioritizes features and then divides them into clusters based on how important or how technically interdependent they are. Projects build one cluster at a time, with small teams creating the highest priority features or functional components in parallel. Milestone subprojects. The feature and component teams go through a full cycle of development, design and coding, testing and stabilization for each cluster of components before moving on to the next milestone. The result is that managers do not have to control projects that, for example, consist of building a large number of features in parallel during 18 or 24 months. Rather, from the perspective of day-to-day project management, the targets are to build only a few features within a 3-month period. The milestone approach may appear to take more calendar time than developing all components simultaneously, then just integrating and testing them once at the end of the project. Even in conventional firms, though, software components tend to change a lot during a project and are difficult to specify exactly in advance. Changes or differences from the original specification then make a product difficult to integrate and test later on, unless there are strict controls over what individuals and teams build. The milestone approach lets teams of almost any size act like small teams and change designs or flush out details of their components. They have this freedom because they can stabilize major parts of the product several times during a project, before so many changes creep into the product that integration and stabilization become nearly impossible. Small team structure and management. With the principle of subdividing a product into features and even features into sub-features, projects can break down product assignments into pieces that a handful of people who are responsible for their own fates can usually build in just a few weeks or months. Small multifunctional groups. We have discussed how the core group for each team is generally one program manager and 3 to 8 developers, including a feature team lead. The extended team includes a parallel feature testing team, roughly equal in number to the developers. Autonomy and responsibility. Chris Peters noted that large teams work when you've pushed the organization or pushed the responsibility very, very low. They work well and they are very, very competitive. But having the responsibility pushed very low is absolutely critical to having them work. The alternative would be to give more responsibility and authority to managers, such as team leads, to closely direct the work of team members. Instead, Microsoft gives each team and each individual considerable autonomy and responsibility. This follows the basic principle of hiring smart people who can work and learn on their own. Autonomy and responsibility allow each team to work relatively independently. For example, individuals and feature teams are responsible for setting and maintaining their own schedules. In addition, they have relatively few rules required for changes. Individuals and feature teams own their features. Projects also tailor development processes and tools. A few rigid rules to force coordination and synchronization. While Microsoft teams have considerable autonomy, projects rely on rigid discipline at a few key points to make sure the teams coordinate their work. Daily builds. Nearly all projects do daily builds of their products. Developers are free to come into work whenever they please, as well as to contribute to the product build as frequently or rarely as they like. When developers check in their work, however, they have to check it in by a particular time, usually either 2 or 5 p.m., after which the project creates a new build. Inspired by people like former tank commander Dave Moritz, product groups adhere to the build rules as if Microsoft were the Israeli military. The daily build process forces individual developers and teams to synchronize their work as frequently as possible. The longer developers wait to check in their code, the more likely they are to encounter conflicts with other features that cause the build to fail. Don't break the build. Teams detect problems in the code before creating a new build through continuous testing, both automated and manual, with buddy testers assigned to each developer. Once they decide to check in, however, a key rule for developers is not to violate the architectural interfaces or interdependencies between features and functional subsystems, or make any other errors that can cause the build to fail. Developers responsible for bugs that break the build must fix them immediately. These guilty people also may have to take responsibility for putting together the next day's build or pay an embarrassing fine. Dave Thompson expressed the seriousness of this rule. "We're absolutely rigid about the idea that you better not break stuff, and you have to code things robustly." Milestone stabilizations. Within certain architectural constraints and practical project limits, individuals and teams are free to change component designs or alter the feature set in the new product. Groups almost always end up changing their final shipping date. During the project, however, managers do not consider it acceptable for people to miss their intermediate milestone deadlines. Communications within and across technical specialties and teams. Several elements contribute to good communications within and across the technical specialties and the feature teams within projects. Shared responsibilities and tasks. We have discussed how, despite some functional specialization and divisions of labor, Microsoft blurs the divisions so that people share tasks and responsibilities. Program managers and product managers together write up product vision statements. Program managers and developers together define the product features. Developers and testers both test code, and program managers, developers, and testers all help answer customer support phone lines after the release of new products. One-site development. All major development efforts take place at Microsoft headquarters, except for some acquisitions. This makes it possible for team members to communicate and solve problems quickly in face-to-face meetings. Bill Gates insists on this, despite his affinity for electronic mail. A common language. Projects rely on a common development language, primarily C. Applications projects also use Microsoft's internal Hungarian coding name conventions. Many developers believe Hungarian makes it easier for them to understand each other's code, even without separate design documents. This practice facilitates code sharing and problem solving. Open culture. The culture of Microsoft is still not too far away from the loosely organized world of hacker programmers. Its people abhor political turf battles, as well as bureaucratic rules and procedures, unnecessary documents, or overly formalized modes of communication. As a result, individuals and teams act quickly on issues they feel are important. Product process flexibility to accommodate the unknown. It is often essential for a company to have products and processes flexible enough to accommodate unforeseen changes or initiatives taken by individuals and teams. This is particularly true in a work environment where managers give individuals and teams significant responsibility to act independently, and in an industry where the technology and market needs change quickly. Evolving specifications. We have described how product managers and program managers create a vision statement and a prioritized feature list at the beginning of a project. Some groups, such as Excel, write lengthy functional descriptions of all or most features. Nevertheless, teams do not feel locked into these descriptions. The specification and details of the features can evolve along with the project. The final feature list may change and grow 20 to 30%, depending on how work proceeds, what competitors do, or what type of feedback the project members get during development. Buffer time. Microsoft projects include a portion of the schedule as buffer time, about 20% in application projects, and as much as 50% in systems projects and totally new projects. The buffer is useful to accommodate unforeseen changes due to unplanned changes in features, unusually difficult bugs, or other unforeseen problems, which always seem to occur. Managers schedule this time in between each of the milestone periods and before final release. Mike Maples explained that projects need to figure out the set of deltas that always happen to upset the schedule. Many delays result from what he called things that happen that you don't know you don't know. It turns out that to a great extent, a team has the same optimism or lack of understanding from project to project to project. Once you figure out what the factor is, the routine is almost a constant. They will always underestimate by X percent. Evolving process. Microsoft managers do not lock the organization into particular practices or tools if superior alternatives exist. If someone has a better idea how to do something and can demonstrate this, teams might alter their process during or after a project. Chris Peters commented on this ability to evolve. I think we know what the current best practices are, and as they change, we change. Key weaknesses. Like any company, Microsoft has many actual and potential weaknesses that managers in this and other companies would do well to understand and remedy. The potential weaknesses are so many because, carried too far, every strategy and principle that we have described in this book can itself become a liability over time. Organizing and managing the company. When we review the principles behind how Microsoft people organize and manage the company, four concerns come to mind. Even a smart CEO has limited knowledge, attention, and longevity. Promoting mostly technical people can create a shortage of good middle managers. An emphasis on bang for the buck can discourage truly creative people. Increasing interdependencies among product units can reduce their market focus. The first possible liability is Microsoft's dependence on Bill Gates as the company leader. It is an understatement to say that Microsoft has done well by this weakness so far. Not only have his instincts been excellent, but Gates has also brought an impressive number of technical experts and executives to Microsoft. He has not made the mistake of many company founders in trying to retain too much control over an organization that becomes too large and diverse for one person to handle. Still, he retains control over strategic decisions as well as key elements of product strategy, and he mediates between product groups. It remains to be seen whether any one person can deeply understand the broad range of technologies and new businesses that Microsoft is now into as a company. Gates launched Microsoft by seeing the future ahead of his peers, or at least acting with more conviction and deftness. His company then skillfully rode what amounted to an exploding balloon of mass market waves for PC software, from simple programming languages to operating systems to desktop applications and beyond. In Microsoft's new businesses, however, Gates has many more complex scenarios to consider. There are many more, and some very large, competitors compared to when Microsoft was establishing its position in the 1970s and early 1980s. Gates is no doubt right that consumer software and the information highway will be huge areas of future growth. But it is not clear that Gates and his senior management team understand how to exploit these new technologies and business opportunities better than anyone else. This is not to say that we would bet against Gates and Microsoft, especially since early maneuvers in these new areas, such as the Microsoft Network, appear to be very cleverly conceived. The extent of Gates' advantage beyond desktop software, though, remains an open question. A related concern is Gates himself, his attention span, as well as his longevity and potential succession. He remains the undisputed leader of Microsoft, and it has often required the full force of his personality to get different Microsoft groups to cooperate. Gates has stated that he expects to head Microsoft at least for the next 10 years, and then to take on a lesser role in the company. Whenever he leaves the post of CEO, he will probably not stray too far, and will certainly remain on the board of directors, just as Paul Allen has. Nonetheless, there will be a huge vacuum at the top that will be difficult to fill. The recent rise of young executives such as Nathan Myhrvold, Pete Higgins, Paul Moritz, and Chris Peters indicates that Microsoft can produce talented general managers, but there is no one obvious person likely to carry on wherever Gates leaves off. A more immediate danger is that Gates has already spread himself and Microsoft too thin, with too many businesses and personal investments to follow all of them with his usual intensity. At least one veteran Microsoft observer has even asked whether the Intuit acquisition attempt suggests that Gates is going soft. Gates and Microsoft once had the will to take on every player in PC software, doing whatever was necessary to win. They challenged Digital Research, the maker of CPM, with DOS. They overtook Lotus and 123 with Multiplan and then Excel. They topped WordPerfect with Word. They defied Apple and the distinctiveness of the Macintosh by building Windows. They challenged Novell's NetWare, various versions of Unix, and IBM's OS2 with Windows NT. They are heading for a direct conflict with online network providers by marketing the Microsoft Network along with Windows 95. In contrast, as discussed earlier, Microsoft launched Money to challenge Intuit's Quicken, then tried to spend over $2 billion to acquire the company, greatly upsetting competitors and antitrust regulators by this decision. After opposition from the U.S. Department of Justice, Microsoft managers decided that this acquisition was not worth the trouble and the money. But we wonder why Gates did not insist earlier that his people make more of an effort to turn Money into a successful product. Second, below Gates and his team of senior managers, Microsoft has weaknesses in its middle management core. We have discussed how Microsoft tends to promote developers into management positions based primarily on their technical skills and accomplishments rather than their managerial skills. Microsoft also grew so quickly in the late 1980s and early 1990s that very young developers took on extraordinarily great responsibilities, such as managing multi-million-dollar and even billion-dollar businesses. Some developers have met the challenge of general management with great aplomb, but they may be exceptions. This is a serious problem because, in almost any company, middle managers make the organization work. Microsoft's primary strategy to deal with this issue is threefold. 1. Grow a bit slower, giving people more time to accumulate experience at their current levels of responsibility. 2. Continue to hire experienced managers from other companies when needs and opportunities arise. And 3. Pay more attention to cultivating middle managers. Microsoft is holding more meetings, retreats, workshops, and training sessions for managers to discuss common issues, exchange experiences and information, and receive more formal management education. Microsoft has also appointed functional directors to facilitate learning across product groups. Thus, it is our impression that Microsoft's top executives are sufficiently aware of this serious weakness. It also seems that these measures, along with slower growth, will do much to alleviate deficiencies in middle management. A third potential weakness is the bang-for-the-buck type of personalities that Microsoft has hired over the years. Recruiting smart people, in Gates's sense, quick-witted young men and women who combine an acute business sense with technical understanding and the ability to learn, has clearly served the company well. But Microsoft employees have generally focused their creativity on developing product features that will sell to large audiences. Most features consist of incremental innovations, and many products have followed the lead of other companies. The consumer and research divisions are diversifying Microsoft's capabilities and stock of people, but Microsoft will probably need more inventive employees in its basic lines of business to keep these areas fresh and moving forward. Fourth are the interdependencies associated with Microsoft's efforts to promote more sharing across its product groups. Strategically and technically, the arguments for doing more sharing and more integrating are compelling. The problem is that Microsoft's underlying organization by products is firmly entrenched in the company culture and, more importantly, presents its own set of advantages. In the past, separate business units have been able to focus their attention on one competitor and one product, and they have had all the resources they needed to build and deliver their own products. This is no longer the case. Furthermore, managing two or three interdependent projects simultaneously is far more complex than managing one project at a time, which Microsoft is still in the process of mastering. More interdependencies will likely result in more product delays and product compromises, at least until Microsoft gets all its key groups marching in step together. Many products are only as good and only as timely as their weakest component. Managing people and skills. Microsoft's principles for managing people and skills suggest four areas of concern. Too much overlapping of responsibilities can lead to confusion and wasted effort. Learning by doing and mentoring can be inadequate for many complex products. A dislike for bureaucracy can result in too much reinvention as well as trial and error. Retention of key employees becomes critical when knowledge is mostly tacit and unwritten. First is the degree of overlapping among the technical specialties that Microsoft has sanctioned. These tracks are essential for cultivating expertise in such highly specialized areas as software development and testing. They have been more difficult to define, however, for groups such as program management, which overlaps considerably with both product management and software development. The danger of formalizing the tracks too much is that this might promote an unhealthy compartmentalization of people and skills, which would not help Microsoft's shortage of people with broad enough skills to be effective middle managers and team leaders. The danger of too much overlapping of tasks and responsibilities, though, is that this can lead to confusion and wasted efforts, or efforts that cross purposes. This appears to occur in Microsoft when program managers and developers cannot agree on feature priorities, and neither the program management lead nor the development lead has clear authority to make a decision. Work then proceeds on more features than are really necessary for the product to succeed in the marketplace, or on features that projects later discard. Gates and other Microsoft managers seem to prefer the lesser of two evils. Some confusion and redundancies due to overlapping tasks and responsibilities, rather than an overly compartmentalized organization. Gates and other senior technical people are also available to resolve conflicts, although instances where they mandate solutions to independent-minded employees and managers are rare. A second weakness is Microsoft's approach to orienting and educating new employees. The company has avoided excessively formalizing this process, ending a lengthy college it once ran for new developers. In theory, training on the job, with guidance from more experienced people serving as mentors, is a superb way to train new people. It allows experienced employees to communicate knowledge that is difficult to codify. In practice, though, this approach is time-consuming and depends on having enough experienced people capable of being good mentors. The system seemed to break down during Microsoft's most rapid periods of growth and within busy projects with tight deadlines. If Microsoft's growth slows, especially in the hiring of developers, the severity of this problem should lessen. Nevertheless, Microsoft and other companies that follow this approach need to provide some guidance to mentors and schedule in time for people to mentor. A third weakness is that there is probably more reinvention as well as trial and error than there need be in Microsoft. Company people dislike formal or written rules and procedures. This attitude is good to the extent that it minimizes bureaucracy and has helped Microsoft to change its organization or adopt new and better practices as they come along, but there needs to be a balance. The postmortem documents, for example, indicate that projects too often